So, may we start?
1, 2, 3, 4! So may we start? It's time to start. My time to start.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Third Act Podcast, episode number 210. I'm your host, Christian Estabrook, and with me, as always, is Jericho Serrona.
Christian, Karl Marx was wrong. Turns out the opiate of the masses is the Third Act Podcast.
All right, dear listeners, we want to remind you, all of us here at the Third Act Podcast, we watch a lot of films, we have lots of opinions on those films, and we're just pretentious enough to think that you care. Jericho, good to be with you again. I don't know when these episodes are releasing. We've been kind of banging them out lately. We're in a creative high point. Are we in any other kind of high point? I don't know, but we are in a creative high point.
Well, one of the films we're talking about does involve OxyContin, so maybe there is some other kind of high points happening, sure. But we do not condone that kind of behavior, and neither does Zach Braff.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the good ones, Zach Braff. Is he? I don't know. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Always glad to get in front of the mics with you, Jericho, though I will say, just to put everything out there, I'm feeling the absence a little bit more of one Armando Rivera this episode. We have a pair of films that he threw out, I believe, solely as a troll. Is that your interpretation?
It was a joke. I think the one of the films, the Mia Hansen Love, was seriously being considered as a possible review. The other film, directed and written and directed by Zach Braff, clearly was not, but Armando threw it out there and was shocked that I jumped on it and was all in on the idea. And of course, Christian being Christian, would immediately also jump on board. So I think it was just a complete surprise to Armando that we were actually considering doing this.
Does that mean he's actually going to listen? Probably not. But he did. He did inspire what we're going to be covering today. So we have two films. One Fine Morning, the latest from Mia Hansen Love, and A Good Person from the aforementioned Zach Braff. Two titans, mounts of modern filmmaking, remains to be seen. But that's what's coming up. I think Armando's original joke was One Fine Morning and A Good Person as titles just sounded so generic and kind of bland that it seemed like a, quote unquote, natural pairing just in the sounds of the titles of these movies. No other real connection that Armando, I think, was implying. And he hasn't seen either of these films, so I don't think he got much further than that. But One Fine Morning, A Good Person, just sounds kind of a piece, I guess.
Yeah, and I think he also threw out One Fine Day, starring George Clooney and Michelle Pfeiffer, a 90s rom-com, as a possible third option.
Didn't get to that one. I have seen One Fine Day, though, in the 90s as a child. Watched that with the family. I don't remember much about it. I think there's a kid. I think it's a very, very quaint. Like, it is not like a raucous romantic comedy or a raunchy romantic comedy. I think it's like the nicest, sweetest version of that kind of movie, if I remember correctly. But we're not talking about One Fine Day. But for One Fine Morning and A Good Person, I elected that we should call this a fine good episode, Jericho. A fine good episode. Maybe we can continue this if we find other movies with similar, vaguely positive, just nice titles. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe this is probably going to be a one-off. But I don't know. I did like the fine good comparison here. And who knows? Maybe we'll pick it up someday. If we can do One Fine Day and Good... I don't know. I don't know. Goodfellas? That'd be a good pairing, right? One Fine Day, Goodfellas. That could be the Fine Good episode sequel.
I'm in.
Let's start off with One Fine Morning. This one, of course, written and directed by Mia Hansen-Love. It stars Lea Seydoux, Pascal Gregory, and Melville Poupaud. The synopsis: with a father suffering from neurodegenerative disease, a young woman lives with her 8-year-old daughter. While struggling to secure a decent nursing home, she runs into an unavailable friend with whom she embarks on an affair. Mia Hansen-Love has been discussed once, a couple of times on the podcast. I believe we did a Bergman Island episode.
That's right.
And then I remember, Jericho, you were there the year Things to Come played at Telluride, right?
I don't think it was that year.
That might have been the year after when you weren't there. So I did see that at Telluride, so that was probably mentioned in some kind of bonus segment or something, the Isabelle Huppert film. I think those are the only two I've seen before catching up with One Fine Morning. I think you've seen more of her work, is that right?
Yeah, but not much more. The big one, I think, is Goodbye, First Love. That mm-hmm. was sort of where I kind of became aware of her as a director, and then I've seen Things to Come, Bergman Island, and One Fine Morning. So I have not seen Eden, right. Or the two that she made before, All Is Forgiven and Father of My Children. I've not seen those. So a couple, but enough to sort of be a fan, I guess.
Yeah, be a fan. And at this point, I think when there's a new Mia Hansen-Love, it's like, oh, okay, that's, you know, that's on the radar, that's worth checking out. Well, you know, want to see what she's up to. Eden feels like a blind spot for both of us. Maybe we should find some dorky title to give us an excuse to review that someday. It does have Greta Gerwig and Brady Corbett in it, who we've talked about both several times on the podcast. So maybe an Eden catch up at some point is due for us. Before One Fine Morning, I'm going to say right up at the top, I'm a real big fan of this film. This is my favorite of the three of hers that I've seen. I think all of them are very strong, easy recommends. And I wanted to make that very clear right at the top how positive I am on this, because I think a lot of the things that I would say about it may not sound as positive as I actually am on One Fine Morning, because I think a lot of what works in this film and a lot of what I appreciate are things that it doesn't do. I think this movie is very patient and very restrained, and it holds back on really going for the big scene, the big moments. I mean, we do get plenty of Lea Seydoux crying. She's a wonderful crier. She's a wonderful crier on screen. I get emotional every time I see her. But I think this movie avoids kind of the real emotional spikes that this type of story you think would go for. Maybe some of the things we'll talk about in the next film, who knows? But that's something that I think is really strong. And not to even, you know, spoil it, I guess. And so I don't think this can really be spoiled. But even where this movie ends, like the note that this movie ends on is not a crescendo. It's not a loud proclamation. It's not a big come to blows moment for any particular relationship or any particular life. It just kind of leaves you with this moment and kind of I don't know, ends on an ellipsis, if that's not too pretentious to say. It just kind of leaves you in this moment and kind of lets the emotions towards the end of the film linger without, I think, coming to like a firm conclusion or even a strong resolution to some of the kind of emotional drama that the movie sets up. So you have, as the synopsis said, Lea Seydoux, who's a young mother. She has an 8-year-old child and an elderly father. And we see her kind of navigate the different poles in the most important relationships of her life. Obviously, a young child is keeping her kind of tied down and tethered in certain ways. And it's a tricky thing to navigate the ailing health of her father. His eyesight is going. I'm trying to see if I have it. I do have it in my notes here. No, I don't. Oh, yes, I do. Benson's syndrome is what her father is suffering from. So it's some type of degenerative brain disease. He's losing his memory as well as losing his eyesight. So over the course of the film, there's kind of increasingly painful scenes of her not being recognized when she does get to spend time with her father. Sometimes it seems to be he doesn't quite remember her, isn't quite retaining certain memories. It's not entirely clear what he's able to connect, you know, at any given moment in a conversation. How much are his faculties all there is kind of a question in a lot of those interactions. And sometimes he seems like he's not able to fully connect because his eyesight isn't there. There's one kind of heartbreaking, again, quiet scene. I think that there's a lot of just quietly heartbreaking moments that aren't going too overbearing in any way. But there's a scene with her and her father, Lea Seydoux's character and her father, and she's asking him, you know, do you see me? Like, can you see me? Can you see my dress? What's on my dress? Is my hair long? Is my hair short? Can you see the flowers on my dress? She just keeps asking these kind of simple, basic questions that, of course, he'd be able to answer if, you know, if he had his full mental abilities there and if he had his full sight, but he struggles with a lot of those. The other kind of wrinkle through this whole interaction is she starts up an affair one day with Clement, played by Melville Poupaud, who is married. We never see much of his relationship with his wife. He has a child as well, but we see their kind of fling that they have. So she has this kind of she has these heavy elements in her life that she's dealing with, being a young mother and dealing with her father's movement to different facilities. They're trying to find the right place for him to be, the right healthcare, the right location, the right support that he needs. They're also dealing with moving him out of his apartment and what that means, packing up all these boxes. So there's all these like heavy elements in her life. And it seems like she's found this escape in this this romantic fling that she's having. And then over the course of the film, there's some passage of time that we see, and it gets to kind of that natural point of, you know, what is this affair? Is there something real here? Is there something serious? Is this more important to him than his marriage? Well, what does this mean for her? She kind of clings to that as a big kind of escape or outlet compared to the other kind of more, the more kind of upsetting things that she's dealing with in her day-to-day life. So I think that the movie's kind of filled with, lots of lovely little grace notes, little character moments. I think Lea Seydoux is wonderful in this. She is cast, I mean, I don't know, I guess the thing that comes most to mind is something like James Bond, where she's just kind of an icy, you know, femme fatale. She's, you know, obviously very striking, so she's used that way often, but here she plays a very kind of natural character, and she's allowed to, you know, given the space to actually fill out a more realistic character. I think she really rises to the occasion. She's my favorite performance in the movie, though. Pascal Gregory is also a performance I was really impressed by in this film. So I don't know. I mean, there's other things in the writing here where things are just kind of hinted at, but not really dwelled upon. Like there's one point where someone mentions there's been enough suicide in the family. And it's not really spelled out immediately, like what that's in reference to, what the connection is to anyone else or anything else. And you get some more context a little bit later in the film. There's also the title, One Fine Morning, which is pretty bland on the surface, but I do think it really hits and is wonderful once you make the connection of what it is in the film. I was going to spell it out, but maybe that's worth saving. There's something that Lea Seydoux's character discovers about her father and really kind of illustrates his mental decline. And it ties into the title of the film that I thought was maybe one of the most kind of touching and, poignant elements of the movie, kind of how that was discovered and how that played out. I found that really moving as well. So I think that there's a lot that this movie offers. It's maybe not all on the surface because it is somewhat withdrawn. I don't know. That's what I keep coming back to. I mean, there's a lot of emotion on display from Lea Seydoux. There's just not the swelling music or like the big dramatic beats. There's nothing that you see like, oh, here's this big moment coming that you would see in other movies. Oh, here's this big relationship moment. Here's a fall. Here's an injury. Here's a death, whatever it is. Like, it doesn't have those things that if someone told me what this movie was and I were to kind of chart, okay, what are the beats we're going to hit? I feel like Hanson Love kind of avoids a lot of those. And what's left is a much more kind of realistic and, for my money, more meaningful kind of exploration of what these characters are experiencing and how they're navigating the emotional aspect of it. So, I don't know. I think that is kind of the main summary of my thoughts. I'm anxious to hear what you think, Jericho. I was pretty taken with One Fine Morning. I'm glad we caught up with it, even if it was originally brought up to us as a joke or as part of a joke. This is definitely one worth watching, and I got a lot out of. What did you think of One Fine Morning?
Well, we're in large agreement here, Christian. I think it proves that Mia Hansen-Love is one of the best filmmakers working right now. I think she's also one of the most underrated. I know she has like a group of passionate admirers, mostly among critics, but I kind of place her in that upper echelon right now because for me, her films always feel truthful. They're never showy. They're never preachy. They're never going for blunt impact. These are all qualities that we'll get to with the next movie that we're talking about. And here she very gently traces the day-to-day existence of this character, Sandra, as played by Lea Seydoux. You know, she's dealing with her ailing father. And this is like the way that Hanson Love does this. It's so hushed. It's so patient. It's so humane, which are things that I've come to expect from her as a filmmaker. And there have been many movies dealing with this kind of subject matter of families struggling with elderly parents, parents with dementia or some other disease. But rarely is this material handled with such care. There's really no melodrama or forced catharsis. Sandra and her sisters are sad about their father's condition, but there's also a casualness about the way they deal with it. That feels true to life. And the mother character here too, she's been divorced from George for a long time. She uses humor and this seeming indifference that also feels believable. There's also the love affair that Sandra has with this old friend of her deceased husband, is the married man played by Melville Papad. And the film juggles this subplot with Sandra visiting her father in a nursing home, as well as her job as a French-English interpreter. And then there's also the relationship she has with her young daughter. And something I really loved about this movie, beyond the pacing, the patience, the very good performances is this idea of the things that we own, the objects that fill up our space, and how those things define us as human beings. There's this whole thing about Sandra having a tough time deciding what to do with all of her father's 20th century world literature, which is lining his bookshelves. This is actually given a lot of time in the film. It kind of defines not only him as a person, but also her relationship to him. And then Clement, the character portrayed by Papad, is seemingly a decent man who ultimately can't decide whether to leave his failing marriage to be with Sandra, which is a trait we've seen many times in movies, and also in real life. And Sandra's basically struggling to keep her head above water. And I think this is where Seydoux's performance is key. I agree with you, Christian. I think she's an actor I've always liked, but this is like the polar opposite of the last performance I saw from her, which is as a self-involved celebrity in Bruno Dumont's France. I feel like she's often too cool or sort of detached in a lot of roles, and especially early on used as a kind of object of male wish fulfillment. I think here she projects a world-weary sadness that's just behind her smile. And even when she does like break down in many scenes, this character still feels like she's holding her emotions at bay. And I think that Seydoux does a fantastic job of portraying that. And this is ultimately a movie about life hurtling forward, that we can't control everything, that people change, relationships end, loved ones get old, illness creeps in. Sandra's just trying to keep it together like the rest of us, and that's what makes this film human and powerful, because like you said, it doesn't do all the things that maybe you would expect from a movie of this type. But what it does do is it just allows you to sit and observe human interactions and behavior, which is rare. So I think it's a kind of a sneaky, great film.
Yeah, I agree. And I like what you said about, you know, the physical objects and how the film deals with that. That was maybe like the primary thing I was responding to in the film. Obviously, there's relationships and parents and aging and disease and all sorts of heavy, you know, topics that this film explores. But that really resonated with me. I mean, maybe it's because one of my most prized, you know, possessions, if you say that I own it, is this large bookcase that my wife built for me once we bought the house that we're living in now. And I just love having a huge stack of books overflowing. I've thought about organizing them many times. My wife really likes them to be unorganized and look overfilled and cramped and, kind of a true to life depiction of, you know, how we interact with books and reading. And I love that. And I love sitting in my living room in the recliner reading. I love looking at it. It's a really important thing in my life, to be honest. And thinking about, you know, I'm not worried about to passing on and what's going to happen to those items anytime soon, hopefully. But the idea of considering what someone leaves behind, there's a lot more conversations in art and in media about the legacy someone leaves behind. What's the emotional impact that someone leaves? That's a very common, I think, idea to explore, and it's done well a lot of the time. But maybe the more practical thing that you and I and the people we know will deal with, because, you know, being practical, being honest, we're probably not all going to have a huge lasting legacy unless someone uncovers these old Third Act podcast episodes and thinks that they are a work of art to be heralded throughout time. possible, unlikely, but possible, you know, will be remembered by our close loved ones. And that's kind of the legacy we leave. At least that's how I chalk myself up. I'm not the most ambitious of people. I don't think there's going to be buildings named after me or anything like that. So thinking about what I would leave behind, you know, besides the emotional, you know, connection from my loved ones, there's going to be stuff. There's going to be things. And what does that mean? And if you have the opportunity to kind of plan for or expect the end of one's life, that you have a lot of time to process, you know, what is this object? Is it important? Is it important because it belongs to this person? Does it remain important if it belongs to me? Is it important at all? Like, that's a very kind of basic, practical question. I know I've had, you know, elderly relatives, and it's like, okay, they've passed away and they have their homes that need to be gone through. They have my grandparents on my father's side. They worked in storage for the later part of their lives. They had storage lockers. You know, you go in and, you know, maybe there's some important things. There's some pictures. There's some things that, you know, don't have monetary value, but or live on. But a lot of it goes away. A lot of it gets tossed. A lot of it gets donated. A lot of it is just no longer needed anymore. I don't know. Maybe I'm making that out to be more profound than it actually is. I'm not sure. But something about just depicting that process, I felt a real connection to. And, you know, stories like this dealing with, you know, illness or death or, you know, these types of relationships, they can be, you know, specific or maybe more like a more grand case of something like this. And that's why it needs, you know, it supposedly needs to be told in a film. But this just feels so grounded and so real that I'm able to kind of pull these elements out of like, yes, I understand this idea. I connect with this. Like that's an element of the film that I feel is really generous in the way it offers something that I think most people can connect to.
Definitely.
And on top of that, it also has a sick Frozen 2 burn, which I did laugh at. Maybe the big laugh moment of the movie for me, if there is one. But for those who haven't seen this, I mean, I don't think it's all sad and dour and things like that. Actually, the other thing that I really appreciate about the movie is kind of it just naturally transitioning into more happy moments or memories. There's a scene where Sandra and Clement are maybe feeling a little disconnected. They're kind of like on a date out in public, and they start playing hide and seek in these hedges around other people. And kind of the joy that they're experiencing feels really true to life as well. There's a really lovely sequence, I thought, where a family is pretending that Santa has come on Christmas Eve while the kids are hiding in a bedroom with the doors shut, and they're, you know, making sounds and eating the cookies and, you know, doing make-believe for them. That I thought was really, really lovely. So it's not all just real big, heavy emotions in this. There's a lightness to it as well. So I think even though if you read about it or you learn a little bit about this, it feels like a really heavy movie. But I don't know. I think it goes down easy. This is, I agree with you. I think it's sneakily great. And it's on VOD now, so easily rentable. I think this is definitely a big recommend for me, and it sounds like from both of us.
Yeah, it's great.
It's great. All right, so that's One Fine Morning. Let's get to the other one, Jerrica. The other film we're going to be talking about is called A Good Person. This one's written and directed by Zach Braff. It stars Florence Pugh, Morgan Freeman, and Celeste O'Connor. The synopsis, a real verbose one for you here, Jer. Here we go. Follows Allison, whose life falls apart following her involvement in a fatal accident. That's the whole plot. That's it. Follows Allison is how it starts too. So Zach Braff, obviously there's some third act history here. He hasn't made as many movies as I thought. Obviously a big like indie success at the time, Garden State. We all know it. We were all there for that. But then maybe a more anonymous directing career from Braff after that. Jericho, do you remember the halcyon days of 2014 when you watched Wish I Was Here, starring and directed by Zach Braff?
I've been trying to forget the last decade or so. Yeah, that was a sort of a iconic one-star review on my website. It was one of those things too where I think Zach Braff gets a lot of shit just in general. I think it was a Kickstarter movie, and
sounds right.
There was a big blowback concerning Garden State, even though it was really popular when it came out. There was a pushback against that movie, you know, years later. So I think it was just a kind of a convergence of events leading to this thing. Wish I Was Here, which is truly a terrible film. But to be honest, I don't really remember anything about it other than musical montages and quirkiness and being overly sentimental. And it was kind of like the character from Garden State, if he was now like middle-aged and like a disaffected husband and father or something. So that's all I really remember. I don't even think there was much of a plot, but it was a seemingly deeply personal project for Braff, but it did not go over well.
Yeah, I never saw that one. I do remember your review of it fondly. But beyond that, the only other feature he directed was 2017's Going in Style. I believe this one got some play on our group chat. I think Armando may have been interested in Going in Style, not as something to watch, but as something to just be aware of and maybe reference from time to time. You remember Going in Style? Three over the hill actors, three yeah. Legends.
Vaguely, I didn't know he did that. He directed that?
Yeah, I think it's like an old guys coming out of retirement to do a heist or something. It's Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, and Alan Arkin. But that seems like I think the only of his films that he didn't write. So it's like it feels like an anonymous, like, hey, we need someone who knows how to point a camera to come in and, you know, take care of this movie with some, you know, people who know what they're doing, you know, get a director who knows what they're doing, get some, you know, it's all actors who know what they're doing. Let's get this movie on autopilot. Again, judging from a distance, I have not seen Going in Style, but that's how it feels like. And that's it for Zach Braff's directing career. Aside from some TV stuff, he directed an episode of Ted Lasso. Apparently there was a show he starred in called Alex, Inc., which only lasted for 10 episodes. He directed 4 of them. And that's it. That brings us to a good person in 2023. And of course, if anyone follows any of these folks on social media, you'll know that Zach Braff and Florence Pugh were in a relationship for several years. And towards the end of that relationship, Braff wrote a movie for her to star in, a project crafted specifically for her to showcase her. And then they've since separated by the time the film came out. So it is Pew all the time for a good person. Zach Braff making a new movie, not getting my pulse up. I got to be honest. Florence Pugh headlining a new movie, that does get my interest, but I likely was going to skip this if not for the podcast, Jericho, to be honest. Maybe I would have gotten to it eventually. I definitely wouldn't have made a priority to see a good person, even though I am a puker, which is of course what our we call ourselves here in the Florence Pugh fandom. What do you think? I gotta know, my friend, was it worth watching a good person? Does the Braff hold it back? Does the Florence Pugh factor save it? What's your take here?
My take is a good person had the potential to be a good movie, mm-hmm. because it has Florence Pugh carrying the entire thing on her back. I mean, this is another deeply felt, very just committed, authentic performance. It's too bad the film surrounding her is just really fake and unconvincing. This is no big surprise given Braff's track record, but I think the film actually has a decent first act where we are following Pugh's character, Allie. She's struggling with Oxycontin addiction after the car crash that killed her fiance's sister and husband. And movies about grief, addiction, survivor's guilt, they're a dime a dozen, but Braff hits all the expected beats. But most of these movies don't have an actor like Pugh at the center. And the real miracle, I think, is that she's able to transcend the false sentimentality and this kind of like wannabe edginess of this material. We care about this character because we care about Florence Pugh. She simply just radiates authenticity. So she's so good here and so much better than anything else that actually harms the movie, I think. If we just focused on her story, on her recovery, I think this thing could have worked, but Braff stacks the deck. It includes this Morgan Freeman character, the father of Allie's ex-fiance, who she runs into at a AA meeting. He blames Allie for his daughter's death, but for some reason, Braff contrives a way for these two characters to come together, spend time with one another. And then we have Freeman's teenage granddaughter, a character who makes really odd decisions throughout. And I feel bad for the actor here, Celeste O'Connor, who spends most of the movie shouting, crying, and having uncomfortable sex talks with her grandpa. It's a really kind of terrible performance, I think. The problem with this film is I think Braff simply doesn't trust the power of watching Pugh's character struggle with addiction and find her way towards recovery. The tragic accident and her addiction to Oxy is enough, I think, because Pugh commands every scene. But then Braff throws in so many melodramatic turns, tragic backstories, childhood abuse, trauma. Even Morgan Freeman brandishes a gun at one point and conveniently showing up at a party to rescue his granddaughter from the clutches of a pervy musician. It's all completely absurd, over the top, which is too bad because it does seem like Freeman is actually trying for once here, but his character is a device, as are all the characters. Even Molly Shannon as Allie's mom, which is also too bad because I like seeing Molly Shannon on screen.
Same.
At times, it just feels like Braff's attempts at a dark, mature film. There's more F-bombs here than in a Scorsese movie. It's just, it's so, like, it just rings so false and hollow. The characters are operating on a screenplay autopilot, and then he tries to thematically tie all these threads and all these characters together. And it ends up feeling just as clean and tidy as Garden State or I Wish I Was Here, which I feel is the opposite of what Braff may have been going for with a more messy, kind of darker film on the surface. But Pugh makes it watchable. She's always compelling. Fortunately, Christian, this movie is just really hacky and kind of commits all the sins of screenwriting 101. And I don't think Pugh is enough. I think obviously she's great and you're never like bored watching her, but it's just like there's nothing, she's not standing on any kind of solid ground. Everything just kind of collapses around her. So despite her valiant efforts, I think A Good Person is a bad film.
Good Person, bad film. We're in large agreement here, Jericho. As I would expect, I think we're pretty much on the same page here. You mentioned it quite a bit in your take. I got to echo and underline and highlight it really can't be overstated how fucking consistent Florence Pugh is. She has got to be one of, if not the most dependable young actor of her generation. It does not matter what the film is. It does not matter what the genre is. It does not matter who the director is. It does not matter the overall quality of the film. She is fantastic basically all of the time. It's pretty remarkable. I say this mostly to follow up. Last year, she was in Olivia Wilde's sophomore film, Don't Worry, Darling, which I had a laundry list of issues with. I think that movie's really backwards and dumb in a lot of ways. But Florence Pugh remains fantastic in that movie, does her best to save it. And my assessment of that is that movie really got lost in the editing, and then they decided to let's just cut everything around what Florence Pugh is doing, regardless of how that makes the movie, you know, make sense in any way. Let's just focus on what Pugh is doing. That was my take on what happened with that movie. And here, I totally get, you know, I don't think I'm always in the Zach Braff headspace. Maybe that's a good thing. But I get the impulse of like, hey, let's make a movie that's just all about what Florence Pugh can do. That seems like a good impulse to follow through on. She's great. She's great in this yet again. Even when the dialogue or the plotting of this fails her emotional journey always makes sense. Her struggles are believable. She is able to elicit sympathy in her down moments when she's struggling the most or the least motivated or the least successful. I think she still brings a life to this character that I don't think is on the page. I think she's bringing that all to this character. She's fantastic. Again, I think that there's moments with some of the other characters that she has, but they are somewhat fleeting. I agree with you. I think this is disappointing from, you know, someone like Molly Shannon, who I really like her when she pops up at this stage in her career as kind of supporting characters. I think she's really watchable and engaging. Morgan Freeman, I read a couple of reviews that were like, Morgan Freeman's trying, he's engaged, he's not phoning it in. Maybe I guess? I agree with you. Jericho, I have it in my notes. I'm glad we noticed the same thing. But the fucks in this movie seem like they are just way too much, doing too much. It really seems like Braff is punching up this script to try and, I guess, be edgy to make it seem more mature, like more of an adult movie. I think that's most pronounced with Freeman's character. I think it's written really poorly. I think his dialogue sounds awkward coming out of his mouth when he starts calling teenagers fuck boy. It's really just groan inducing, really eye rolly. And there's lots of like would be cutesy things like that. There's like a party where people are doing VR. There's random jokes, like people trying to make light of serious situations, and almost all of it falls really flat. Like there's a conversation of like, I think it's in this bar, and they're like, oh, like you should know where the opposite point is on the planet. Maybe you belong there. Just like these attempts at being like, I guess, deep or thoughtful in some way that all feel really hollow and fake. And it's not fair to this movie, but in talking about these two together, I think it just makes it even more pronounced that this movie doesn't feel real for all of the moments that you and I could call out in One Fine Morning that feels really true to life or authentic or really connects in some way. I think a good person has maybe just as many moments that just they just hit the ear wrong. There's just a line of dialogue or how something, sounds. It's just not quite there. Just a little off key. I agree with you. I was kind of on board to a degree with this movie through the start, maybe even like the first half or so, mostly because of Pugh's performance again. I think she was carrying it quite a bit. So I was kind of giving the movie a pass for the most part. I mean, there's lots of things that I really bugged me. I watched this with my wife. I think I was like, "Oh, Zach," out loud, like several times. One of them being very early in the movie where there's, you know, like the shots under a sheet of like loved ones canoodling. And it's like, Jesus Christ, you cannot do this without being self-aware. Like, this is the most cliche, like doomed lovers thing to put in a movie like this. What are you doing? So there was some groaners along the way, but I was kind of on board for the most part, like having a decent time with this. But you mentioned it. There is a jump the shark moment in this, Jericho, and it is absolutely Morgan Freeman showing up with a gun. This is like throw popcorn at the TV, get up and leave in protest. It's so fucking stupid. Like, without it going there, like, I think that one scene, that one decision to bring the characters there is just like a massive hit on this. Without that, I actually might be like lightly recommending this, like with reservations. But that, I think, is just at least a half star letterbox debump for that scene alone. It is rough. It is rough. It's so odd. It strains credulity. It's so, like, the amount of characters that are important to the story that are in that one scene suddenly, Pugh and then the granddaughter and Freeman and the person who runs the AA meetings and the boyfriend, like everyone's there all at once. Like, everyone just shows up in this one scene at this one moment for this would-be dramatic payoff. Wow. Like, that was galling. That was like, that really, really sapped the little bit of investment or energy that I had in this movie. So that's a huge bummer. I mean, there's other things too, like the score or sound effects that play when Morgan Freeman's staring at a whiskey bottle in the cabinet. Like, yes, I get it. He struggles with, you know, alcoholism and addiction, and he has a dark past. Totally get it. I really don't need you putting your thumb on the scale that hard in the soundtrack in order to, make that clear. I don't know. It's tough. And there's some simple things I wish worked better too. Like you mentioned, there's this contrived way in which these characters keep interacting with one another. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Like Morgan Freeman's character wants Pugh to interact with the granddaughter at times, and then immediately 180s the very next scene, like, don't talk to my granddaughter, stay away from her, and then back the other way again. And I couldn't really track why he was flip-flopping so much on what he wanted from Florence Pugh's character. So I don't know. It has some moments. I think, you know, if you're a puker, if you're way in on Pugh, I can't recommend it, but it might be worth a watch because I think she does it again. I mean, it might be the case where, regardless of the movie, her performances just need to be seen if you're a fan of her work. But the movie absolutely does not rise to her level, unfortunately.
Braff is busted.
Braff bracket busted.
There you go.
I mean, he does ask Florence Pugh to sing in the film, gets her in on the soundtrack. You know, I'm not too angry at him, you know, Zach. Disappointed.
It's also like, if you're really going to write a role to show what an actor can do, I mean, she has a little bit of levity at the beginning and a chance to do some comedy, but this is like really just, we know she can do this dramatic stuff and the crying. Yeah. I mean, she does it great, but like, I don't understand. We've seen other sides to what she can do, even in the Marvel movies, right? Where she gets to be funny. Oh, yeah. I just feel like she doesn't get a chance to be funny or to be charming or, you know, sweet enough. And she has some very like spare moments in this, mostly at the beginning. And a couple interactions with Freeman later involving trains, which is another thing that was ridiculous.
Big train movie, this one, Jericho. It's a big train movie.
Sure, train energy, model train energy. But
yeah,
and at least if you're going to do that, give her some variety of things to do. It's kind of the same arsenal of tools, which, you know, I'm not arguing against it because she's great at it, but it just seems. It's not her fault, but it's kind of one note after a while. It's it's really just the screenplay is poorly written. Even an actor of Pugh's caliber can't really save it.
Yeah, it's a good point as far as like giving her a range of things to do rather than just hitting the same note over and over again. Probably the best portion of the film is after the tragic accident when she's in burnout mode. You know, she's just kind of slumming it in the house, like with the curtains drawn, and she interacts with Molly Shannon. You know, they kind of have like a back and forth. There's a little, you know, again, I'm not praising the dialogue, but there's a little patter, you know, there's a little rat-a-tat in some of the back and forth. You know, she's able to, you know, get a little bit of energy rather than just be sad. I think that's maybe the best stuff. That's maybe the best portion of the film. I don't know. I mean, I kind of am, I guess, recommending if you love Pubie. Like, there's that scene that I think is poorly written, but like in the bar when they're like, you know, someone's like accosting her as she's like trying to score. She's trying to get more oxy or whatever. And they're like forcing, like, say I'm a fucking junkie. I think that's the line.
It's terrible. It's terrible.
It's really poorly written. She crushes it, though. I mean, she nails what she's asked to do. I don't think anyone, including her, could have performed that scene the way it's written better. It's a poorly written scene. It's really on the nose. She kills it. I mean, she's great. I think it's a great moment from her. So, I mean, if you're a completist, you got to do it. And she does reward. It does have the patented Pew frown, a better Pew frown than Don't Worry, Darling. I was waiting for it there. She doesn't quite go full frown in that one. This one, we get the full Pew frown, not the iconic, you know, Midsummer Pew frown, of course, but we do get a full Pew frown. So if anyone is, you know, keeping track at home, do we get the full Pew frown? Yes, I think we do, in A Good Person. And that's something. That's something.
It's something.
Is it enough? No. Is it something? Yes. I think that's going to wrap us up. Does that wrap us up, Jericho?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a fun one. I mean, despite the Braff being, for me, kind of a train wreck. You're welcome, nice. Armando.
Yeah. Armando, who is not listening, you are welcome. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I am very glad for the excuse to watch One Fine Morning. The majority of movies I watch these days.
Go watch, everyone, go watch the Hanson Love film. It's out there. Go watch it.
Easy recommendation. I expect if we, you know, do a year ender, it'll probably get mentioned, even if briefly at that point, would be my expectation. So I think for me, maybe for you, I think for the podcast, it's probably going to linger. It's probably going to stick around for this year. So folks should really circle back and catch up with One Fine Morning. Absolutely. No question. Jericho, we've done all sorts of episodes recently. I feel like we have not been a train on rails. We've just been going off road. We've been doing this. We've been doing that. We've done a fine, good episode here. I think it's time. Maybe next episode, air Jer. Is it? I think it's time.
It's lurking. It's possible. I mean, the Amazon Prime launch of the Ben Affleck film Air is right around the corner. So it could happen. Well, will happen, but sooner than later.
Yeah. I mean, by the time this is released, that should be available at home for everybody. So I think we're going to have to make good on that Air episode. Will it be the very next one? Maybe, maybe not. We're kind of, you know, we're flying or we're sailing without a flying, without a sail, sailing without a sail. What's the expression? You know, the one, I don't know what I'm saying. Let's get out of here. I think that's going to do it for episode 210. We're also recording like multiple episodes a week now, and I think this is going to be out of order. I think this is 210. Whatever it says in the title of the episode, that's the correct number. All right, give me a break. But that's going to do it for this episode, for One Fine Morning, for A Good Person, One Fine Episode, whatever the hell we're doing here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Keep up with us. We're on Facebook and Twitter. You can email the show, thethirdactpodcast@gmail.com. Are there any BRAF supporters out there? Any BRAF braggadocios out there who want to take us to task? Go ahead and do so. Any pukers in our numbers that want to get at us? Let us know. Is anyone checking out One Fine Morning because of this episode? That would be quite gratifying. Please do so. Let us know if that's a decision you make. thethirdactpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Jericho, any final thoughts?
Nope, it was a blast and a blessing, Christian, as always.
Blast and a blessing. And with that, remember, dear listeners, that the greatest act of all is the third act of the rest of our lives. Make the best of it, and have a good night.